Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. Recently, actress Katharine Hepburn died. And she was noted most after, not only second after her long career, but most on the event of her death for something she said shortly before she died. People talked about it and talked about it after she died. She said, "I'm not afraid of hell, but I'm not really looking forward to heaven." And people wondered what this might mean. Is this some kind of courage, not being afraid of hell? Is this an irreverence for God or a lack of belief in the existence of hell? I don't know. I don't know when it comes to Katharine Hepburn. I remember when I was a teenager, I had to register for the Selective Service, and I was counting the years between my 18th birthday and being old enough where I thought they still couldn't draft me. They couldn't draft me if I was, say, 30. I was counting the years. I didn't want to go to war. It was something that I actually probably feared about as much as anything, about as much as say, the atomic bomb dropping on my house, being drafted and sent off to war. After all, I was a baby of the Vietnam generation. War and hell, two things that people ought to fear and fear. Maybe Katharine Hepburn was ill-informed about hell. We'll talk about hell and war in just a moment. Before we do that, on the heels of our conversation with Pastor Whedon, this series that we're doing on the historic liturgy, let me remind you, and I've told you about this before, about an event sponsored by Concordia Publishing House and held at Concordia Seminary August the 15th and the 16th called Now the Preparation, Then the Proclamation. It's a seminar on Christian worship. It includes topics like hymnody and preaching and worship, all the things that we're talking about in the series on the historic liturgy. Over two days, Friday and Saturday, August the 15th and the 16th, Now the Preparation, Then the Proclamation. If you'd like to attend this event, you can get more information by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or simply go to the CPH website at www.cph.org. Look for this, Now the Preparation, Then the Proclamation, August the 15th and 16th. You can find out all the registration costs and things like that there at www.cph.org or by calling 1-800-325-3040. We'll be talking about war and hell for this first half of the last hour. Pastor Scott Stiegelmeyer is our guest. He's pastor of Concordia Lutheran Church in Brentwood, Pennsylvania, and author of an article in the latest issue of the Higher Things magazine titled War is Hell. Scott, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Hell, and when I was a teenager, hell probably was a second to war. I didn't want to go to war. That was the last thing I wanted to do. Should we fear war more than hell?
Well, I grew up in the 1980s and during the Cold War, and we heard a lot about nuclear proliferation. There was a lot of anxiety, at least I think amongst my peers, about the possibility of nuclear annihilation. And yeah, it was pretty unsettling for us. I don't think that war is the worst thing that there could possibly be, though.
So, I would take it war is not worse than hell.
No, I don't think so. That would be sort of the premise of my article. You hear that cliche all the time, war is hell. And I certainly don't want to in any way make light of the tragedy of war and the sufferings of war, particularly as we have young men and women in uniform in harm's way right now. But at the same time, I think that when we say war is hell, I think that actually makes light of hell.
So war is not hell. Hell is hell.
Yeah, that's right. I think so. Sometimes people think, I've heard this comment before. I've heard people say, I believe in heaven, but I'm not sure I believe in hell. I think that hell is just this place, this world. Hell is man's inhumanity to man. And man's inhumanity to man is pretty awful. But there is something even worse, And that is what the Bible describes as hell, being eternally separated from God.
Is that what Jesus means, at least in part, when he says, do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell?
Right, I think so, because, you know, we tend to just sort of look at the world, the material surroundings, and we think that this is all there is. And so we become very nervous and anxious about our troubles, our economic problems, our family issues, even things like war and all sorts of other large issues and small ones. But I think what Jesus was trying to say there is that, or one of the things that the points that can be made as an application from that verse is that there is something beyond the concerns of this world. And if our greatest fear is simply what happens to our bodies, then we're missing something, and something that we need to be thinking about at least a little bit.
Now, what does the person who says, I don't believe in hell, I'm fine with the concept of heaven, but I don't particularly believe in hell, what is it they are missing? Not the point, but what is it that's absent from their theology, if you will, if they either refuse or ignore the fact of hell?
Well, I suspect two things, possibly. One is that they have a misunderstanding of what grace is, and they want to think of God as love and loving, which is correct in itself. But I think then they can't reconcile how a loving God could at the same time condemn sinners to hell, because they don't have an understanding of God as a just and righteous being as well. The other thing that I think that people sometimes fail to grasp is the gravity of sin. And I think that they are very content with their lives. I think that people oftentimes are optimistic about human nature. And the notion that there might, well, maybe, you know, they could imagine some really bad person in hell, some Charles Manson, Adolf Hitler type person. Maybe that's, you know, what hell will be for those people. But I think many people think that they're basically good, and that it would be unfair of God to condemn them.
So what does Scripture teach hell is?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think, you know, hell is one of those subjects that it seems to me that most of the verses that we get our teaching from hell from are from the Gospels. Now, I haven't actually sat down and added them up and counted them for sure, but I think most of what we know about hell comes from the mouth of Jesus, which I think is kind of interesting. Sometimes people think of maybe St. Paul as being, you know, maybe a little harder to get along with, but it's actually Jesus who talks about what hell is, at least in the specifics. And what he tells us is of a place of suffering. It is a literal place that is an eternity of suffering, being bound to our sins and being sent off to be with the devil and his angels. And I think that Hollywood or others might try to, you know, embellish that or come up with some specific ideas of what that looks like, but the point is that it is described as a fiery place, fiery torment, and one that is everlasting, not just sort of a momentary annihilation, you get burned up and then you're gone, but as some groups teach that, but rather that it is an eternity of suffering.
Here's a very subtle distinction, although an important one, that was recently pointed out by a guest here on the program, and that is that hell is not as popularly believed absence or being outside the presence of God, period. It is being in his presence, but having none of his mercy or grace. It is being in God's presence only according to his wrath.
Right. Well, that's right. You know, I mean, that's, you know, God being everywhere, it's about being an object of wrath. You know, that's what we are by nature, is that we are objects of God's wrath, Ephesians chapter 2. We are dead, and we are deserving of damnation in hell. To be an object of God's wrath ought to be, I think, the thing that would concern humanity more than anything.
Now, you point out something that's very interesting in your article. It's something of an irony, and that is war, that is the warfare that we witness here on Earth throughout human civilization, is not so much the result of man trying to create hell on Earth, but the result of man often trying to create heaven on Earth. What do you mean by that?
Well, the reference that you're referring to is I draw on J.R.R. Tolkien's great fantasy epic, The Lord of the Rings, which is, I'm sure many of your listeners have read the books and or seen the movies, which are coming out and are very popular. Those are basically a story about a great war, and Tolkien writes in his letters about that whole drama, and he says that it's really about the fall. His story is really about the fall, and to him, what the essence of the fall is that people or the beings in his fantasy world want to make this place a perfect place. They want to make Earth a paradise, and so they invest all of their attention into making this place a paradise, but forgetting that we are intrinsically sinful and corrupt, and that any efforts that we attempt to do are going to be corrupt as well. And so to simply try to set up a paradise on Earth is going to result in great tragedy and great suffering. And I think that's one of the points that Tolkien is trying to make, is that that people ought to be mindful of another world, a better world than this one, rather than simply trying to manipulate nature or one another to make their version of paradise.
What do you say to the person, Pastor, who says, look, I believe in heaven and I believe in hell, and I believe that my ticket to either one really is not yet punched until I make up my mind? I am kind of born neutral between the two, and God is rooting for me to go to heaven, and the devil's rooting for me to join him in hell, and it's really up to me. I get to cast the deciding vote.
And what's really funny is, or not, it's not funny, but it's just striking to me, is that I do hear that kind of mentality. I do sometimes hear people say things like, you know, I'd rather be in hell where, you know, where it's fun and people are enjoying the sins of the flesh rather than in heaven, which would be thought of as boring and dull, like going to church maybe in some people's minds. And again, I think what's being missed there is the seriousness of our sinful nature, the seriousness of our corruptedness, that we cannot choose God. We cannot come to him. He must come to us and create faith in our hearts through the gospel. And for someone to think that they have that much power over their eternal welfare is also a mistake.
Why is it? I mean, you explained the reasoning behind someone who would deny the fact of hell, but why do you think it is that when even Christians are polled, most of them say heaven, yes. A very significant number of them say no. There is no hell. Beyond the denial of the sin, the seriousness of sin, and the misunderstanding of grace,
sure.
What is it in man that he would deny what Paul says, you're naturally born as children of wrath?
Yeah.
Why would we deny it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that is, I guess that's one of the mysteries of our depravity. I think that we prefer blindness to seeing the truth. I think that there's part of our fallen human nature which would rather see ourselves as self-sufficient, would rather see ourselves as, and even Christians. I mean, Christians still have these attitudes and mentalities at times, because we are also all sinners. You know, I think that it boils down again to a misunderstanding of who God is, and not understanding that because of his righteousness, that sin must be condemned. He cannot tolerate sin.
Scripture gives us kind of this scenario of human history in a nutshell. It says, in effect, that all of the wars and the tragedies and the hells on earth that man constructs for himself,
yeah,
are but a precursor, a preview of God's ultimate day of judgment and the fate of those who die separated from him.
Yeah.
Is there anything here in this life, on this side of eternity, that corresponds to a preview of heaven?
Well, I would say definitely. And I would say that is found around the means of grace. And what I mean by that is the gospel, the good news that the Son of God became a man and offered his life as a ransom for sinners, and that is proclaimed to us through preaching, through the word, and that that is offered to us in visible ways as well through the sacraments of baptism and in the Lord's Supper, and that when God's people gather together around that, around the gospel, and Christ is in their midst, that is a precursor, that is a vision of heaven. And we even say it in our liturgy, you know, that we are singing with the angels and the archangels at the same time, and we are singing with all the saints in heaven. We are, at that moment, sort of straddling reality with one foot on earth and one foot in the world to come. You know, one of the reasons that I wrote this article, Cold War is Hell, is obviously the war in Iraq, which was raging at the time. And but in my Bible class at church here, we were reading through 1 John. And John writes about not loving this world. And, you know, not that doesn't mean we don't love people, and it doesn't mean that we have some kind of a bias against creation itself, but that not loving the ways of this world. And I think that even Christians really struggle with that as well. Not seeing that we have something better than this world. I've had people tell me that it's hard not to love this world when this is all that we know. But we do know something more. We do know, we have had a glimpse of that other higher reality, the better one.
You mentioned before the person who says, look, I'd rather spend an eternity partying in hell, even if it's hot and they keep the heat up, than sitting around with all those stodgy Christians in heaven.
Sure.
What about the truly mournful? And I'm talking about the person who's maybe lost a husband or a wife.
Yeah.
Who is genuinely uncertain as to whether or not this person is in heaven or hell. And they say in the midst of that sadness and that grief, I would rather be with them, even if it's in hell, than be apart from them if it's in heaven. How do you respond to that as a pastor?
Well, that's a very good one, because that's a very good question, because that sort of question does get asked, and those sorts of comments are made, and sometimes in our even very devout believers, in our grief, we do think that way naturally, and it's sensitive, and one has to just sort of sometimes you just allow people to vent their thinking and their feelings, and wait for a more opportune moment to correct that if they're in error. But one thing I would focus on is that heaven is being with Jesus. Heaven is being with God and being united to him. And, you know, sometimes I've even heard the opposite of that is where sometimes in funerals we're tempted to make the really good news about a funeral sermon is that, well, one day we're all going to be reunited. Well, that is true, I believe, and I think that that's something to look forward to and to take some comfort in. But what's really joyful about the message of the resurrection on the last day is that we're going to be with Christ, not just that we're going to be with one another, but that we're going to be in God's nearer presence. And so I would direct someone to think about that, I think, and to think about being with Jesus. And that in heaven, there's no marrying or giving in marriage. And, I mean, our relationships on this earth very often are just temporal arrangements.
Someone's going to say kind of a variation on that theme, but how can I be happy?
Yeah.
And okay, I know I'm going to heaven. I know my husband and wife, my kids are all going to heaven. They all believe in Jesus, and that's good. But how can I be happy in heaven knowing that hell is full of people who are suffering?
Well, I once asked a group of people this question. I said, is it a good thing or a bad thing that God damns sinners? And they had to think about that. This was a group of Christians, and they had to think about that. But ultimately, they couldn't say that God would do anything bad, that everything that God does is good. And that's very, you know, I understand how difficult that might be for us to get our brains wrapped around that idea that even God judging sinners and condemning them to hell is good, because God can only do things that are good. And I think that in heaven, we will rejoice in his justice. And we will rejoice that he is dealing with his creation according to his own nature and according to his own will.
Someone who says war is hell, you've said they're really underestimating the severity of hell. Someone who says I've got a little bit of heaven on earth, I mean they really mean it. I got a little bit of heaven on earth. Are they underestimating the bliss of heaven?
That could be, because very often what they're talking about are things that really are not very very big in the grand scheme of things. Sometimes we think that we are happy, and we think that the peak of happiness is merely found in material blessings or in physical comforts and leisures. And if we try to somehow equate those things with being a glimpse of heaven, then I think we are. I don't think we're quite getting the glory of heaven and how wonderful and how beautiful it is. And it's beyond our ability to describe it.
This is kind of the tough question, especially given our proximity to this event, and that is the towers falling in New York.
Sure.
Someone says, I watched that on television, and I can't imagine what it must have been like to be there in those towers with the fire, with the destruction and the death, the mayhem, and then, on top of it all, not just to perish in a fire, but to perish as those towers came collapsing in upon themselves, thundering to the ground.
Yeah.
And they say, I can't imagine that God would send someone, and there are people in there who are unbelievers, that God would send someone who died in that way to hell. I mean, isn't that bad enough?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a very sensitive topic, and I think that as Christians, our responsibility is to respond with the truth, and to do that in a humble manner, and to do that in a generous manner, but we have to correct people and make them aware that no, there is something more than just physical death in this life. There is the torment of eternal punishment in hell, and I know that that's hard for us. That is a difficult teaching. I think very often that is one of the things people stumble over the most. And of course, we wouldn't ever want to make hell sort of the main theme of our preaching. But I think it's important for us. We need to hear about hell. It has to be there. It is clearly part of Jesus' proclamation. There was an ancient church father named Polycarp who was arrested and was going to be, he was an elderly man and was going to be executed. And the Roman official who had the power of life and death over this man ordered him to renounce Christ or else be thrown to the lions or else be burned at the stake. And Polycarp's response was something to the effect that, well, Jesus Christ has been my Savior for all these years, and I'm not going to denounce him now. And I am more worried about another fire than the one that you could light here today. That man understood it. He understood that whatever can happen to us now is a mere speck compared to the terrible things that can happen to us here are a speck compared to the glories and wonders of being with Christ in heaven.
Pastor Scott Stiegelmeyer, thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Pastor Scott Stiegelmeyer is pastor of Concordia Lutheran Church in Brentwood, Pennsylvania, and he's author of an article in the latest edition of Higher Things magazine. It's titled, War is Hell. You can check out the website for this new youth organization and magazine called Higher Things by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Under that section called Links with Regular Guests, you're going to find a direct link to Todd Peppercorn and Higher Things. Or if you'd like your teenage or college age or child or grandchild to get Higher Things magazine, you can write them, Higher Things Magazine, P.O. Box 580111, Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, 53158. That's Box 580111, Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, 53158. When we come back, Phyllis Schlafly.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In recent church history, one of the church's most vocal advocates has also been one of the church's most vocal critics. He lived and worked in Germany during the Third Reich. He died in a Nazi prison camp, executed at the order of Adolf Hitler himself. He was Pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You can order Till the Night Be Past online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. Or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Fossils. Evidence for Noah's Flood.
Answers with Ken Ham, co-author of the best-selling book, The Answers Book. Well, Ken, is there any evidence that fossils have formed quickly?
Well, this is a real important question. You see, the evolutionists teach that the fossil record forms slowly over millions of years. And I found that most people have the impression that therefore fossils form slowly over millions of years. Even many Christians believe this. But creation scientists believe that most of the fossils formed at the time of Noah's flood just 4,500 years ago. This means that fossils must have formed rather quickly. Well, is there any evidence that supports this? There sure is. I remember being in New Zealand and visiting a museum where they display a petrified ham. Now, it was formed after a village was covered by volcanic ash. I've also seen in a museum in the state of Tasmania in Australia a petrified hat. This is a miner's hat that was left in a mine, and after 50 years, well, it changed from being a soft hat into a hard hat. No, it doesn't take millions of years to make fossils. Actually, fossilization can be quite a rapid process, and most fossils formed during the flood of Noah's day just a few thousand years ago.
But doesn't carbon dating show that the world is millions of years old? For the truth, read our free booklet on our popular website, AnswersRadio.com. You'll discover what true science teaches about the age of the Earth. The carbon dating booklet is available free at AnswersRadio.com.
Advocates of abortion claim to defend the so-called woman's right to choose. But what about a woman's right to know?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Abortion advocates have been fighting a law in Indiana that requires an abortionist to provide women with information about abortion and its risks and about fetal development at least 18 hours before the procedure. The more a woman knows about abortion and its risks and about fetal development, the less likely she is to have an abortion. We see this as a good thing. Informing women and reducing abortion are the benefits of right-to-know laws like the one in Indiana.
The Susan B. Anthony List is dedicated to supporting pro-life legislation, training candidates and activists, and promoting pro-life leaders. To view all this month's commentaries, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we feature the CPH Book of the Week. It's titled Faithfully Parenting Teens. How do other parents do it? How do they set boundaries with teens, solve problems, communicate, and most important, how do other parents keep faith at the center of their relationship with their teens and prepare for circumstances before they occur? We'll give you an idea of what this book's about tomorrow morning, give away a few copies, and talk with author John Buca, Reverend John Buca, on The Morning Show on AM 850 KFUO.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to review two books by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. One is Life Together, and that's probably one of the more familiar little books that Bonhoeffer put together. And the other is called Spiritual Care. Our guest tomorrow will be Pastor Hal Sinkbeil of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Those two books by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, dovetailing nicely with our Issues Etc. book of the month for July, Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Phyllis Schlafly joins us for the remainder of the program today. A new study has been released by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development on the relationship between what's being called non-maternal care and child aggression. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Phyllis Schlafly is president of Eagle Forum and author of the new book, I'll tell you about it in just a minute, called Feminist Fantasies. Phyllis, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you so much, Pastor. Good to join you.
All right. Tell us about what this new study from the NICHD, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, has to say about daycare.
Well, it has something very important to say about daycare. It's quite a study, and it came out with the conclusion that the more hours children spend in daycare, the higher the incidence of problem behavior. And that means disobedience and over-assertiveness and the greater the severity of those negative characteristics. Boys were more vulnerable than girls to the negative effects of daycare. And it's a terribly important study, which was done, as you said, by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. That is a branch of the National Institutes of Health. And this was a 10-year study. It started in 1991. It followed more than 1,000 children in 10 cities, and it covered all ranges of daycare arrangements, including centers, preschools, care with nannies, and care with relatives.
Now, someone is going to say, look, especially those who are advocating nationalized daycare and things like this, they're going to say, look, this study shows that, you know, anybody but mom can bring about, if they're caring for the child, that situation can bring about this aggressive behavior in children. And we've got studies that show the kids who go to daycare may score better on tests and things like that. It's always going to be a trade-off. And after all, mom can't stay home and take care of those kids.
There are no replicable peer-reviewed studies that show that. It is very inconclusive, a number of the other studies that have happened over the last few years. We had a survey by Dr. Bacharach, who spoke at our last meeting, and he analyzed four or five well-talked-about studies, and they're very inconsistent. They're not peer-reviewed. They won't reveal the sources of how they made their evaluations. But this one that has just come out is a very authoritative study. And furthermore, it was corroborated by another study, which was made by the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota, which found that in children younger than three, levels of cortisol, which is a hormone associated with stress, rose in the afternoon during full days the kids spent in daycare, but fell as the hours passed in the days they spent at home. So I think these studies are extremely important. And I think they confirm common sense that infants are not ready for an institution or for this warehousing of children with 30 other kids, all of whom are sneezing and coughing and have daycare diseases. Children simply do better at home with their mom.
Phyllis, my wife, she works in a kindergarten classroom in a parochial school, and she sees this in many ways firsthand. She sees young kids, and we're talking about five-year-olds in this case, sometimes less than five, four and a half,
mm-hmm.
coming in. They have been in daycare before school, sometimes even provided by the school.
I bet she can tell the difference between the daycare kids and the mom-raised kids.
Absolutely, Phyllis. She says the kids that have been in daycare from 6 o'clock that morning, and then after school, they're going to go to after-school care until maybe 6 o'clock at night, and then their parents pick them up. And what do? You feed them. You get them to bed, and then the next morning it's back to the daycare or to the school. She says there is a marked difference between the kids who come from home to school under the care of their parents, and especially their mom, and then go from school to home back to the care of their mother. Is that a common observation?
Yes, I've heard many people say that who deal with children and who see the different kinds. They can tell them, even in the walk through the park, the difference between the ones that are wheeled by their mommies and the ones that are wheeled by a nanny. It's just very different. And this big study that you asked about at the beginning of the program showed that the other factors didn't really make a whole lot of difference. I mean factors such as the quality of the daycare, the mother's sensitivity, and the family's socioeconomic status. It really is the fact that the child was put in institutional care away from the one person who's most important in that child's life.
We were told about 10 years ago in a very popular book by the former First Lady Hillary Clinton that it takes a village to raise a child. Now, how has this village philosophy, how has this been shown to be wrong? What's wrong about it?
Well, we need to realize that when she uses the term village, it's a synonym for government. And she was a former head of the Children's Defense Fund that has made a career of trying to get the government to take over the raising of children. Now, this comes from several sources, one of which is the feminist ideology, that it's so unfair for society to expect mothers to raise their children. This is an example of the oppression of women in our society, and what they need to do is lift this burden from women's backs by having the taxpayer provide daycare. And then there is the view of the people who really are promoting this whole a social welfare state, and they just think government is capable of solving our problems and meeting our needs, and we need to, these people who are hired in daycare are so much more qualified than the poor old mother or grandmother. And it's a very unfortunate philosophy. You know, there was a great effort to institutionalize daycare as a middle-class entitlement in the years 1980 88, 89, and 90. And I led that battle against it, and we won it. People don't want to pay for babysitters for other people's children. And there's another good trend that has come, another trend that has come out recently, in that more mothers are staying at home these days. It was quite a sensational report that was given by the Census Bureau. Moms at home are up 13% over the last decade. And again, this is must be a big shock to the feminists, because they were hoping that all women would be soon out in the workforce. But there is a big rise in the percentage of mothers who are going to stay home and take care of their children. So I think that's good news for the babies.
We're talking with Phyllis Schlafly, president of Eagle Forum, about this new study released by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development on the relationship between non-maternal care and child aggression. She is author of the new book called Feminist Fantasies. Let me tell you a little bit about it. It chronicles not only Phyllis's experiences, but her thoughts over the last few decades regarding the issues of feminism and what feminism has been trying to do through government, through legislation, through a cultural force, and what it has done to women, to men, to our children. You can purchase Feminist Fantasies by calling Spence Publishing at 1-888-SPEN-PUB. That's 1-888-SPEN-PUB, S-P-E-N-P-U-B. They're currently offering this book at a 50% discount, 1-888-SPEN-PUB. Or you can order Feminist Fantasies online at Spence Publishing's website, which is SpencePublishing.com, Spence Publishing, all one word, .com. Phyllis, give us some more detail here. How does daycare fit into the feminist agenda?
The feminists simply think it's oppression of women to expect mothers to take care of their babies, and they look forward to the day when all wives and mothers will be out in the paid labor force. You hear them talk all the time about women only make 75 cents for every dollar a man makes. Well, that's a big lie in the first place, because it's not an example of any discrimination. It's an average figure of all women compared to all men. Now, in that figure are women like myself, who spent 25 years raising my six children. So I will never have the pay in the labor force of a man or woman who has stayed in the labor force all those years. But then the feminists look forward to getting all the wives and mothers in the workforce, which, of course, means that the children have to be taken care of by somebody. So they want the taxpayers to subsidize that with institutional daycare. And it's just not the kind of society we want. The feminists over the years have changed the attitudes of a lot of women and some men. But I have noticed they haven't changed the attitudes of the babies at all. They have exactly the same attitudes that they had 100 years ago.
You know what concerns me, Phyllis, and that is what happens when a daycare generation, children raised in daycare, what happens when that generation grows up?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting point you raise, because this new statistic that came out from the Census Bureau, that there's a big increase in the number of stay-at-home moms, has people trying to figure out what caused that, because we've been told, you know, we're steadily moving toward all women in the workforce. But some of the experts are crediting this unexpected increase in full-time mothers, and not only to something of an economic boom in the late 1990s, but particularly into the entry into parenthood of this generation of daycare and latchkey kids. And it seems that in this first generation of children who were raised in daycare and latchkey type of life have decided they don't want to inflict that on their own children. It's just a curious turnaround.
So something of a backlash, if you
yes.
will.
Yes, it is.
But if it is true that those who are raised in daycare, non-maternal care, experience increased child aggression early in life, for those who take this to heart, you know, we've got things like Columbine, we've got kids, and this is, we no longer even blink now when we hear that someone's taken a gun to school and shot up their teacher or their classroom or something like this. Can we expect more?
Well, I think so. And, of course, what is probably even more serious if you're going to talk about crime and delinquency is the lack of fathers, the fathers in the home. It's just if an enemy had come and taken and shot up millions of fathers in this country, it just couldn't have done any more damage than what has happened with this era of social permissiveness, easy divorce, no shame for illegitimate children, and all of the factors that have led to children being raised without a father in the home.
My wife and I made a conscious decision, and I'm not trying to boast about this. This is a decision that a lot of just basic common sense people made. We made a conscious decision when we had our first child, and that was that for the first couple of years, she wasn't going to work, and that meant things were tight. But we wanted, I wanted my children raised by their mom. I wanted a parent home with them. And I was able to work out of the house at the time, so that worked out pretty well. And we made the same decision with our second child, and that this would be, the daycare would not be an option. And ironically, my wife even worked in daycare during part of this, after my daughter was a little bit older, between the daughter and the son.
I've talked to women who've run daycare, and they get very burned out about it. It becomes a very unhappy experience for some of them when they see the children and how hard it is on them.
But I look at my kids and I say, my kids have never known being dropped off at a place of business with a bunch of other kids to just be kind of taken care of in the idle hours of the day. And if we did this to them, they would both be terrified. They would hate it.
Yeah. But
I want them to expect that. I want them to expect that mom and dad will be home and taking care of them.
Well, they're very fortunate, but just don't say your wife doesn't work. I'll bet she works very hard.
Oh, well, you're absolutely right. She was working, even when she was home with the kids, she was probably working harder there than any job. Is there a solution to this, to child care?
Well, the marketplace provides somewhat of a solution. It is expensive. You know, if your wife is dealing with kindergartners, she can probably manage 20 or 25 kindergartners. But when you get down to 2- and 3- and 4-year-olds, it's very labor-intensive, so it is expensive. And the expense of it does keep it down. And we hope that nobody's going to move into saying that the government should take on this responsibility. The government's got a lot of other things to pay for, and that shouldn't be one of them.
You've mentioned several times tax situations. What does the tax code have to do with the whole daycare, child care?
Well, it's really unfair to the stay-at-home moms, and that's one of the things we've worked on for years in Eagle Forum. If your wife puts her child out in a daycare institution and pays money for that, she can take it off her income tax. But if she cares for the child herself, she doesn't get that deduction. And I think that is one of the discriminations against the full-time homemaker that exists in the income tax code. So we've been working on that for years, but I don't know. I think the employed women have got maybe a more effective lobby in Washington.
How do we go about changing the attitudes of parents in general? Because this isn't only a mother thing, Phyllis. You know, it's a mother and father thing. Parents, as you've mentioned, who have kids and consider it just absolutely natural to let someone else raise the children while they pursue their careers, and maybe they get a couple hours in the evening with the kids and the weekends. And then they'll say on Sunday evening, boy, I can't wait for Monday when we can get the kids back to daycare. How do we change those attitudes?
Well, I'd get them to read my book, Feminist Fantasies. I have a lot of stories of women who, very successful career women, who gave up their career to stay home and take care of their children. I've got one poignant story of a female doctor who... she and her husband decided that her career was moving faster than his, so she would stay with the life of being a busy surgeon, and he would stay home. And then 15 years later, she's still unhappy about that choice because she thinks she missed out on something. So you find when you try to go really against God's plan or the traditional pattern or what seems like common sense, which is that babies need mothers, it just doesn't work out. There are all kinds of regrets that come along later.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment for Phyllis Schlafly, give us a call now at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The picture, I find this kind of odd, the picture that the popular media presents to us of the family is a strange picture indeed, Phyllis. I was watching some sitcoms last night. The kids, if the storyline doesn't directly involve the kids may be part of the cast, but they're not running around, rolling around on the floor. The kids are not just seen and not heard. They're not even seen. And these are family-based. I'm talking about the premise of the whole sitcom is that this is a family with a mom and a dad and three kids. But the kids only show up for convenient quips and comic relief. What picture of the family are we painting for America?
There has been a long-running effort to get rid of what we call the traditional family. It was back in 1980 that there was the White House Conference on the Family, which the feminists got changed to White House Conference on Families, so they could recognize different lifestyles and different types of families. And these people have kept at it, and you see what's going on now with this tremendous push for same-sex marriages. It's the good people have got to learn to stand up and defend the institution of marriage and the traditional family and the honored role of the full-time homemaker and the honored role of the father as provider. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's now in the Supreme Court, wrote in one of her books in the 1970s that she wanted the concept of husband breadwinner, wife homemaker eliminated. That is the antagonism and the hostility. And the feminists have carried on this campaign against marriage and against motherhood and full-time homemaker for 30 years. And now we find that the homosexual movement is moving in for the kill. They want to recognize them as the same thing as a husband and wife. And I think the people who care about themselves, their families, and the future of our country, and particularly the pastors in the churches, need to speak up and defend the institution of marriage. It is the foundation of our society, and it's the best, the original Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. It's the nest that you come home to. It's what gives you the challenge to and the energy to face all that's going on in life, because lives are difficult.
Larry is calling from Collinsville. Larry, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon. This week on this very radio station, I heard Dr. Dale Meyer referring to a South American country, I believe it was Venezuela, considering making children under the age of 18 the property of the state, whereby, for example, even parents would have to get permission to take their kids on vacation. This is kind of an odd thing, I hope, or at least Plato in his Republic sort of talked about this too, or something like this. But is this sort of a trend that we're seeing in the world, or just, like I say, some sort of oddball thing?
Well, I hadn't heard of that particular one, but I do know that the United Nations Treaty on the Rights of the Child has a committee of so-called experts who go around among the countries that have ratified the treaty, and they try to impose some busybody rules on them. And, for example, they've been into England and telling them that they shouldn't have the right to withdraw their children from sex education, and they ought to stop spanking their children. And so there are people who, I think they're anti-family, but anyway, they're out there trying to interfere with the rights of parents and make children the wards of the state. That is exactly what that treaty would do. It was signed by President Clinton and never ratified by our Senate, and I hope it will never be.
Dick is calling from his car. Dick, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you. I wonder if you could ask our guest. I heard her say that we should take a stand for Mary Agenda, traditional family. What can we do? And thank you.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things I'm supporting now is, and I think is going to be introduced shortly, is a bill in Congress to take away jurisdiction from the federal courts on the issue of what's called the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. Now, this was a law that was passed several years ago, signed by Bill Clinton, and similar laws passed in 38 states that recognize marriage as something between a man and a woman. And it's a very important law. And we are fearful that this activist judiciary may try to create some new law, as they did in the Lawrence case a couple of weeks ago. And so I would hope, if that gets going, that we should take away jurisdiction from the courts to make any change in the DOMA law, which is a good law. Now, it does not solve all problems, but it does solve some of them.
Phyllis Schlafly, thank you so much for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Oh, thank you, and I hope your listeners get my book, Feminist Fantasies.
Phyllis Schlafly is president of Eagle Forum, author of that book, Feminist Fantasies. You can order the book online. Go to Spence Publishing and their website, spencepublishing.com. It's all one word, spencepublishing.com, or call them 1-888-SPENPUB, S-P-E-N-P-U-B, 1-888-SPENPUB. Now, Feminist Fantasies is currently being offered at a 50% discount, 1-888-SPENPUB. Tomorrow on the program, here's a little bit of homework for you tonight. Go online, look in your church bulletin, see if your church has a mission statement. A mission statement. I am interested in what your church has as a mission statement. You can probably find it on their website or in the Sunday bulletin. That's where these things are usually put. Look it up. Tomorrow, be ready to call during open lines. We're going to take your phone calls on church mission statements. Is it based on a Bible passage? Do churches need mission statements? What if you don't have one? Or what if it doesn't seem to bear any resemblance to any Bible passage you know? That's open lines tomorrow on Issues Etc. I was told when I was very young, raised in a big family, look, buddy, this is a big family, we all love you, but this family is the training ground for life. What you learn here in the first years of your life as a child, amidst all your brothers and your mother and your father and the dogs and the cats, will be the basis for the rest of your life. It was very true. The family is the training ground for life. I am concerned about children that are not being raised by their families, by their mom, their dad, their siblings, that the training ground that they're being trained for life in, the daycare center, is not training them for life, not a good one. It's a concern I have. It's a concern I'm sure you share as well. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.